It's okay. Eventually, everyone finishes second to Spain. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
He's not wrong. Suck it, Paredes. Welcome to episode 674 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us. And in the second half of this doubleheader of episodes, we are talking about IndyCar's 12th round of the season. It's the Music City Grand Prix at Nashville, still recovering from Scott Borchetta and the greatest generational fumble in music history. Unlucky. We still have a Grand Prix instead. I say Grand Prix. It's a shame it ended up being on Monday instead, especially now that we know, because Fox dropped a little PR handle earlier today that said 39 million people watched the World Cup final.
Yeah. And that's the original. That's only the people that watch Fox Sports. If you add in the connoisseurs that watch the Spanish broadcast on Peacock/Telemundo, you tack on another like 28 million on top of that. Don't ever tell us that we don't deserve a seat at the big boy table again. Roast U.S. soccer for other shit like the pay-for-play schemes and us underachieving when I still believe we had a team that could have at least gotten spanked by Spain in the quarterfinals. But because yes, everybody gets spanked by Spain, except for Cabo Verde.
It's weird that and we had a World Cup final between two teams that couldn't beat Cabo Verde in 90 minutes. It's weird how these things turn out.
Yeah, and Argentina went from looking like they were completely outclassing England, especially in the back half of that semifinal matchup, to basically just like Franco Colapinto scored more points in Argentina than that final.
Yeah, pretty much. That was a weird ass playing football.
They were interested in playing whatever the opposite of football is.
I don't know. British Bulldog. It was a gorgeous spear by Paredes after the game was over. Looking from an England standpoint about the World Cup, it's a good thing when we consider third to be a perpetual disappointment. But at least we gave y'all something by beating France 6-4 in the bronze final. That's a game of football right there.
Why was the fucking dead rubber match so much better than the final?
Because no one gave a shit. That's why we just thought, fuck it, let's do some shit. Let's play some football, gentlemen.
As a person of Irish descent, saying this, but I felt bad that y'all lost because, like, at least England making the final would have been something different.
I appreciate the fact that England was apparently actually a fair bit more likable than we normally are at World Cups, because normally people can't wait for the English to fucking lose. But apparently everybody thought Jude Bellingham was really hot. So it was like, oh, actually people don't mind if England actually make it deep in the tournament this time round. And England are actually good now. As opposed to just being perpetual disappointments like the Americans apparently have been.
The thirst for guys like Haaland and Cucurella, though. Oof.
Erling Haaland has become like an internet superstar overnight. It's actually scary how viral he has gone off the back of this World Cup. And it helps. He's also like the best number nine in the world right now. It helps. But in case you haven't been listening for the last 5 minutes, forgive us for the delay on that. That's RJ O'Connell. We also have Cam Buckley. Hello, Cam.
Hello, everyone. I keep getting away with it.
And so Lamine went to Lionel and said, this time it is you that is being washed.
It is amazing that the world's biggest Alex Palou fan got away with one again, and I'd argue now might have one hand on the championship by winning an oval race, which is still apparently a minor surprise in the eyes of some people.
They made a mistake. Normally, in the mystery box of IndyCar oval races, there is not a primary and alternate tire. But they've added Alex Palou's favorite black tire to the mystery box.
Ah, the black tire run, the thing that gives Alex Palou his godly strength. Besides apparently gold World Cup replica trophies. Tune in. Also, we have a guest. He's been very patient waiting to get his line in, and now I can finally introduce him properly. You know him as a writer for frontstretch.com and perpetual troll of 1,000 stories. It's Chris DeHardy. Hello, Chris. How's it going?
Roses are red, water is wet. Spain winning twice? I'll take that bet.
Oh, he thinks he's slick.
Oh, he's close. He's so
smooth. I know.
He's smooth.
Well, so we're going to talk a lot about the calamity and the wildness that this weekend was, and a lot of things that just it seemed like nothing just went right.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to kind of go just fast forward in time to the very, very end of the weekend to kind of show just how bad things ended up getting at the very end. As Sarah and I were on our way back to Indianapolis after the race was over, we were behind the Meyer-Shank Racing haulers that had left the track, which, by the way, those things look very, very nice, if I may say so myself. As we were driving along Highway 109, just a four-lane highway in outside of Nashville on our way to Interstate 65, we happened to find a massive truck that was broken down on the side of the road. I say broken down because the hood was up. It was Starship, the truck that actually holds IndyCar's technical inspection equipment and administrative equipment that is powered by natural gas. And
I have seen this truck.
Oh, it's a monster. And yeah, I wasn't expecting to have an active Cup Series driver see the tweet and like it. But that was a very wild sequence of events, and one where Sarah even said, you really shouldn't have posted that. To which my response is someone else was going to if I didn't. By the way, Cam, since you don't know, would you like to take a wild guess who that Cup driver was that actually saw the tweet and liked it?
You said they're active?
Yes.
Given that truck was at the same town, I'm going to assume Connor Zilich tweeting.
Yes, it was. It was.
Hey, yo!
Incredible.
Well played.
Connor Zilich allegory.
That is the perfect, like, I don't know if you call it a metaphor or what, to perfectly describe just how just nothing went right. And we're going to get into that in very great detail about what happened out in Lebanon, Tennessee.
Yes, best laid plans never survived contact with the enemy. The enemy in this case being everything.
Everything. Right, let's get into that. But first of all, the nitty-gritty of social media and all that shit. So places you can find us real quick. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101. If you want to get video highlights of the show, you can on our Instagram page, motorsport101 pod, and our TikTok, M101_podcast. You can follow three of the four of us on Blue Sky as well. Trent Harrison, RJ O'Connell, and CBuckley917. .bsky.social. Chris DeHardy is still on the hellhole that is Twitter, @CDeHardy, if you want to follow him on there, alongside us @motorsport_101. Our website, motorsport101.com, has all of my written thoughts on the race in this past weekend, F1's Belgian Grand Prix, and of course, IndyCar in Nashville. There should also be an Ask Dre up in the next couple of days as well. And if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our episodes. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as a whole heap of you are doing right now. Apparently, this was the main event of the evening. Ed, Kira, Max, Jason, Ghost Raptors in here as well. All you guys in there, thank you very much for watching and listening on. Appreciate you as always. Right, without further ado, let's wrap our heads around at least some of the shit that went down at the Music City Grand Prix. It was meant to be the dream World Cup overrun, but the Music City Grand Prix had other plans. Right as the show was about to go live, a lightning hold hits the track. It then pisses down with rain afterwards. Just when they're drying the track and you think they might be able to get going again, a storm hits. A huge rainstorm, and that is effectively the game changer. That effectively ends any hope or attempt of getting a race underway at all. So the race was postponed to 3 p.m. Eastern the following afternoon. And because the day's running had a heat warning planned, they had to reduce the original plan was to have this race be expanded from 225 to 300 laps. It was knocked back down to 225 again. So it was as you were for last year. Carl Kirkwood qualified on pole ahead of Joseph Newgarden, Scott McLaughlin and Alex Palou. The big news of the weekend going in was David Malukas having to start from the rear of the field after wrecking his Penske in practice and actually taking a short trip to the hospital for a bruised knee. Thankfully, he was fit to continue, but his car missed qualifying, so of course, back of the grid start. Kirkwood and Newgarden ran side-by-side for the early run of the race, but quickly fell into a queue due to the dirty air following another car. Malukas stayed out early after we got an early caution due to Kyle Collette hitting the outside wall, his third DNF on four oval starts this year. And Malukas gapped the field on his hard tyres while running off sequence. And this is the part where Cam Buckley grins profusely. The race took a drastic turn on lap 122, right at halfway. Alex Rossi is slowing peeling off for the pits, and Scott Dixon drives into the back of him. Both cars are basically out. Rossi was out immediately. Dixon was able to continue, but he was seven laps down, effectively ending his day. And Alex Palou had hit the pit road commitment line before the caution came out. So as a direct result, he's able to pit while the field is circulating at pace car speed. And by the time it all shakes out, Palou is leapfrogged to the front of the field. Huzzah. After that, well, David Malukas, who was the big winner of originally being on sequence, has to basically, he's back on sequence, but he's down in 11th place. Palou would then lead the next 97 laps at the front of the field, surviving the beehive of angry Penske's behind him, as he'd go on to win the Music City Grand Prix ahead of the three Penske's, Newgarden, McLaughlin, and Malukas. Malukas was third, I should say, McLaughlin was fourth. And with Kirkwood hosed on an undercut after Dennis Hauger crashed late on, and he ended up in 10th, Alex Palou now has an 83-point lead in the standings with six races to go. So that was Nashville in a nutshell. And I have to point the finger firmly at Captain Smug over there, and that's a.k.a. Cameron Buckley, because Alex Palou, and I'm not saying he was bad or an undeserving winner or anything along those lines, but you have to admit, sometimes it's better to be lucky rather than good, because I don't think he was winning that the old-fashioned way, Cam.
Well, the good news is that that's all that's required, and he gets a couple back from earlier in the year when he was painting the field's back porch red and then got fucked on a caution. I am fine with this.
I bet you are. I mean, I've said it before. Palou maybe isn't the best oval runner in IndyCar, but he's not a million miles off that status, RJ. And, well, yeah, if you give him the right scenario and the right car, he can now win on ovals. This was his third oval win of his career.
Yelling at the rooftops that, like, Alex Palou being a top five oval driver in the series, maybe the top three, should not be a surprise anymore. Like, we've seen him win the Indianapolis. We've seen him win the Indianapolis 500 already. We've seen him win on short ovals before. This is not really a short oval. This is more like a Texas-size oval. You maybe take out a few hundred meters out of the equation, and okay, it's not as fast all around, but this is more like Texas than it is, you know, Iowa or Milwaukee or what have you. Like,
it's a medium oval.
Yeah, it's more of an intermediate, right? I wouldn't consider it like with all the others, but regardless, Alex, this should not be a surprise anymore. And to the point about being lucky than good, yeah, Alex Palou, it seems like he does have a golden horseshoe. It just so happens that it's a man named Barry who's sitting on the pit box, because often, and he hasn't always been on the point, but a lot of the time, Barry wants a strategy really, 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 it's like part of the package. Like, Palou, fantastic driver. Barry Wanser, one of the top strategists in the field, it all works together to create this seemingly unstoppable winning machine.
It's the reason why he calls that team the Perfect Tens.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to argue with that. I mean, and look, real talk, Barry's gotten it wrong a couple of times this season.
Yeah, exactly.
Where the 500, he was on the, we don't think this race is going to get all 200 laps in Strat. It didn't work out. I don't think he had the car to win it down the stretch anyway because of the wing damage that we got docked a few points for. But yeah, I think he was on the wrong strategy ultimately anyway. You know, it didn't work out. They got the fuel number ever so slightly wrong at Gateway, and that cost him two laps, and then he shot there in a race that he was leading several laps out of as well. So Barry's not been at his best this year. But what I will say is, the two times he's got it majorly right this year, Detroit and now in Nashville, he's won. And a lot of that was almost purely off that strategy call because, I mean... It's a little, I mean, if you're a Penske, Chris, in this instance, you've got to be a little bit frustrated because it's another day. This is an easy 1-2-3. You're locking out the podium and Penske's laughing in everybody's faces and getting out of here. Maybe even Malukas winning his first race from the back of the field.
You know, it's really crazy that for all the talk about, you know, we talked about luck and all that kind of stuff. It was, I think Dave first said in the post-race press conference that Alex Palou made it onto pit road just 0.3 seconds before the lights came on for that caution that basically saved him. But you look at Team Penske, you've got Joseph Newgarden finishing second ahead of David Malukas, who started in the very back of the field, and Scott McLaughlin finishing fourth. Like, at some point, you have to ask yourself, like, what has Alex Palou unlocked that has made it to where now, like, he's a guaranteed threat on ovals? Because his first oval win was the 500 last year. Before then, he was always good to get a decent result, but you never knew if he had that last little 1-2% to make it on an oval. And he's made it. He's done the damn thing, actually made it all work. He's figured out how to take dirty air off of Joseph Newgarden. He caught lap traffic in the right way when he got past Louis Foster, which that's probably one of the biggest reasons why Joseph Newgarden was upset after the race, was because when he caught Louis Foster, he was coming off of turn number two, and that cost him enough time to where he lost the race by almost 0.9 seconds. Plus, it was also really freaking hot. Oh,
so amplifies bad. The dirty air.
Yeah, and it's just... There were a lot of, and this is also Joseph Newgarden's home race. He's from, 35, 45 minutes of here?
He's from Hendersonville. He's from the same place where Double J Jeff Jarrett was from, man. Like, that's, like, this is his home race. They never mention it. Dude, I had literally put out there that David Malukas was putting belt to ass. He was getting back pay with interest. And then the yellow comes out and flips this race. Like, not going to twist it. I think the Palou fatigue, I recognize there's Palou fatigue, but that's not me. But I was just like, God, what has David Malukas got to do to win one of these?
Continues to podium, Max, all the way home. To kind of address a couple points there, Chris, I think a big part of it is where Ganassi's oval program has gone, because there was a 2 or 3 year stretch where they just weren't that good. After they were insane in 2023 and they could basically sneeze a top five car into the Indy 500. But also the fact that Palou, like we talk about Kimi Antonelli being a learning computer, Alex Palou is the scariest learning computer of a driver I've ever seen in my life. You plug him into Ganassi, immediate win, immediate championship. Ovals were okay, and every year he's gotten better at ovals. We were both on the ground in Milwaukee last year as it took a literal act of God to stop him crushing the field.
He was winning that race by 9 seconds when the rain sprinkle happened.
Literal act of God. You plug him into a GTP car, he's the second fastest driver at Daytona this year. He just has this incredible capacity for absorbing what is necessary to get lap time out of a car and do it without chewing up the tires. and doing it in the way it's like an old post of mine about Max Verstappen in 2023. He's fluent in over 6 million forms of kicking your ass.
Yeah, it's terrifying how good he is at this, and he doesn't stop being good. He gets better. He's still
getting better, Dre.
I mean, I think there's one element of his season that I don't think anybody has talked about this year. I mean, this is his fifth victory, and he's good for about 5 wins here, which 5 is more than enough to normally win you a championship in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know what his average start is this year? It's 3.3.
That's not bad, is it?
I was literally about to say 3.5, blindly. Yeah,
it's terrifying. He goes, that's another element of this. One, he's become a very, very good overall qualifier as well. And part of that is because he's always leading the championship, he always gets to go last, which is usually an advantage because this is when the track temperatures go down and cars typically run better when it's colder. That whole idea of being able to keep yourself out of trouble while also taking advantage of the qualifying format, because on ovals, you go in reverse championship order. It all adds up to Pelot just basically not having a weakness as a driver at this point, because he can win anywhere. He's good enough where he can win anywhere. That was his 24th IndyCar win. He now ties Bobby Rahal on the all-time list. He has as many wins as Bobby Rahal. He's 29.
I've got more stats there. Podium number 50.
50.
Because when he doesn't win, he's right there. Chip Ganassi win, number 150.
Yeah, which is remarkable. Like,
responsible for over a third of those.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think so. Now, wouldn't you? Dario's got a few in there. Mr. Zanardi's got a few in there.
Yeah,
like soul. The thing is, like, Pelot gets to the front, and even I'm thinking, because I was at work when this race was happening because of events, which we'll get into. I saw him get to the front of the queue, and I'm like, I'm grinning at work. And I'm like, oh shit, Joseph Newgarden's behind him. It's Nashville. He basically owns Nashville. But where Pelot planted his feet, the line did not move.
Yeah. I think there's a few little elements at play there, and I think, unfortunately, the dirty air of Nashville was probably one of them. Again, 33-degree weather. It was heat-warning weather. Dirty air was amplified. I think you were able to run side-by-side for, like, the first maybe 5 or 6 laps of any stint we got.
Tires would just die off.
And then the tires would die off to the point where the high line was no longer viable. And you had to get in line unless there was a mistake from somebody in front of them, whether they got caught in lap traffic or maybe they had a twitch somewhere. Unless that happened, or you have to check up somewhere, passing was very difficult.
Which... doubled up as well, Dre, by the fact that, the events of the weekend meant that there was nary a grain of rubber in this racing surface, because it all got washed off on Sunday night.
It all got washed off. I mean, let's talk a little bit about what happened leading into this. And again, could you imagine what the number would have been for TV rating for this race if a 38 million viewer leading to the IndyCar race goes down? We could be talking Indy 500 level numbers here.
I don't think it's Indy 500 levels, but like it's going to be more than like a 1.5.
Absolutely. Like, that would have been
your audience. You're looking at 1.5, 1.6 million viewers.
That's fine.
Like, that would still be a huge boon for a race directly after a World Cup final, because everyone would be watching the World Cup final under normal circumstances. You getting a dream lead-in would have been huge. I mean, look, even the broadcast treated it like this was like you'd never seen an IndyCar race before. Yes, there were some cringy IndyCar football comparisons, like, oh, Scott Dixon's Cristiano Ronaldo, which don't insult Scott Dixon like that. But you get the gist in the sense of they treat it like this was the first race for a lot of new timers, which is understandably the right approach to take, because you assume there'll be a lot of people that don't normally watch you
Joseph Newgarden as Neymar Jr. because they're both broken down and washed up.
Yeah. Well, at least Joseph doesn't stop, drop, and roll whenever he wins a race. But no, even so, it was again, it was a nightmare scenario. They just had a lightning hold minutes before the broadcast was meant to start. And for those who don't know, or maybe outside of the US, if there is a lightning bolt within 8 miles of the track, you have to evacuate the building.
Yeah.
You have to have a minimum 30-minute delay in whatever event you're carrying on with. And that happened right before the broadcast was set to go live. They do the smart thing. They interview Alex Palou, whose country has just won the World Cup. So, of course, he's going to be giddy as shit that Spain has become world champions again. They introduce people to the series and all of that. And then it starts raining, which is just...
It starts bucketing it down. Chris took a video of it raining from inside of the pit lane, and I'm just thinking, you know, with all the circumstances, the only thing, the only music that would be fitting to play over this is the NFL and Fox music, but not the one you're thinking of. It's the other one you're thinking of, the piano version, the mellow version, the one that they play whenever
the injury music.
When somebody on your team is just being carted off, like for a long
time. I've just walked to the fridge, get another snack, and I hear that, and I spike the fucking brownies on the ground right tackle tears an ACL. I don't know.
It's what we Brits would call the big piss, and that was already at, like, I want to say, like, 8:30 PM
time, which was the smart call.
Actually a small window where there was no rain, and the jet gyres were going, and it was, I think it was around like 6:45 or so when it started to get the track drying underway. So race control had everybody get out of pit lane. They said, we're going to dry pit lane first. That is the priority because there's no drainage on pit lane. Zero.
Yeah.
Absolutely zero. And they had the jet dryers going around the track. And I actually got a video of turn four saying, hey, here's the track. You can see the jet dryers. You can see the track right there. You know, bit of work to do. And then all of a sudden, just after 8:30 PM, I look up and I see the clouds and I'm like, oh, that ain't good. Nope. And then 5 minutes later, a couple of sprinkles. 5 minutes after that, I'm going inside the garage area. Next cars were not there, so we actually had space in the garage to actually see, some of the Ganassi McKinnick were playing Flip Cup with Red Solo Cup.
Cha-ching.
The Meyer Shank crew were playing Cornhole. There was a game of Euchre, which is some Midwestern card game that I still don't know how to play, even though Sarah said she would teach me, or at least one of her relatives said that they would.
Yeah.
There were a lot of different ways people were trying to entertain themselves, because at that point, there's nothing that you can do.
Yeah, effectively what's happened in this scenario is, we talk about Ayagura's second wind.
Oh, yeah.
That second storm was an Ayagura style second wind on that rain cloud.
Yeah, forget it. That was the, there's no way we're racing tonight, because by the time that stops, it's going to be hours before that gets sorted out. Because general rule of thumb, if an IndyCar track is wet, it takes about an hour if there's no other rain to dry it. Depends on obviously size of track, how many jet dryers, etc. But general rule of thumb, it's about an hour. And that was just like, well, forget it. Like, and race control rightly said, okay, we're coming back tomorrow. Which came with its own set of problems. As we talked about earlier already, it was 33 degrees, which, you know, was shit. They didn't have the staff to effectively run the place properly, because unfortunately a lot of people are either volunteers, they've already got other jobs, and of course it's a Monday now, so a lot of people are also back at work, because, you know, you're probably not taking time off for a motorsport race. You're back doing your average 9-to-5, so they had to open the stands with $10 tickets on the weekend. Which, you know, it's a good move in that you want to get people through the door for a race on Monday afternoon. If you're not doing anything, you know, come down, see some racing for dirt cheap prices. Yeah. Why not? You know, it's a smart move. The problem was understandably, the people that had already paid full price for a race they could no longer go to were understandably a bit miffed.
Well, don't worry. You can still walk through the garage with the pit passes that you purchase. And oh, wait, you can't do that either. Again, because of aforementioned security concerns.
So yep. From what I gather, the IndyCar Nation passes were not honored, but they didn't tell people, or a lot of them were not told until I think right before the gates open. But if you had like a single event credential, you were still able to get to the infield, because I took a picture actually of the big board that's at Pitt Road, and it actually had the single event credential, like it says Nashville on it. Those were actually still honored, but if you got those through IndyCar Nation, I don't think those were actually still honored. But I say that a couple of friends of mine were actually in the infield after the race was done, and one of the biggest reasons why was they had I think they had either an infield parking or crew parking. Someone was in that area, which that's right. Another thing too, by the way, all the crew members were parked outside the track on Sunday because of the rain. That area was going to be pretty much a bog the whole day. So they actually allowed all the crew members to park inside the track where the Indy Next cars had their paddock, but they had all left the track by that point.
Yeah.
Lack of communication. Lack of communication. What a, it's not ideal.
So hold on. You get your season long fan club, like your fan supporters club, who I know IndyCar Nation membership is not zero. You gave them the cold shoulder, but single event pass are okay. It can't be one or the other, right? Season tickets are not honored, but a single game pass is fine.
So I will say this. There were, and even that some passes weren't. Like, I have a very good friend of mine that paid almost $200 for garage access, and her pass was not, $195, and that pass was not put in. So it was very confusing because, like, some were valid, some weren't valid, and it was just a nightmare.
Until you actually traveled to the track and tried
exactly.
to make the track make good on it.
Exactly.
Which is just not an acceptable outcome.
And part of it, you mentioned earlier part about staffing, I think also part of it is, and this is just me just thinking out loud here, so don't take this as like 100% gospel, but the event staff there, if my reasoning is solid on this, maybe, but I'm wondering if there weren't any staff available for the trams to take people from the grandstand to the infield and back throughout the race day on Monday.
You think they're going to walk through the tunnel? Monday. Absolutely not.
You could walk through the tunnel, but you have to go all the way from the main straightaway all the way to turn four, and it's just a nightmare. You would need Heelys.
Exactly.
It's just all kind of snowballs together into a race where IndyCar should have had a huge carryover on TV, and it's a popular venue locally. And every possible thing conspired to fuck this event over.
And we haven't hit meltdown yet because almost all of the water refill stations were actually taken out from underneath the grandstands. Dude,
like was the most nonsense thing ever. And like
that's genuinely dangerous at that point.
Yeah. And I know that they went through and said, well, as a result, you can now buy bottled water for just a dollar from any one of our concession stands. Like, cool, that's great and all, but like, that's still a bad look considering you've pushed this race back to not Monday night, where at least, like, okay, it would have been warm, but you get some relief. It's Monday afternoon during the middle of a heat wave. You already shortened the race 75 laps because of the heat.
You're accommodating your drivers, understandably, in the heat, but you're not accommodating your fans and constituents.
To go back a little bit, I'm willing to bet that the water refill stations were probably a rental and they only had them through Sunday, which one thing I'm actually wondering is there, and there, someone much smarter than myself, I know we're talking about a very high bar here, probably has the answer to this better than I do. Is there weather insurance for events like this to where if you get that, would it cover like paying security people, paying track workers, paying, you know, such and such, to where they can stay there an additional day, you know, for the weekend? Now, granted, some people might have other jobs. They can't do that.
Right.
But would that be something that would actually help out in this situation? Now, I say this,
well, the last time that we had killer here, right?
The last time that we had a race that was actually postponed till the following day was Barber 2018. So it's like you're doing that for 8 years without any need to use it, but you have insurance in case something happens. You don't want to use it.
When we saw this happen, well, we saw a very similar kind of situation on the ground happen with the 2021 Belgian Grand Prix. That very soggy, very horrific weekend where we fundamentally we got a race to the regulations is what we got, and not much else.
The shortest Grand Prix ever.
Yeah, the teams felt, understandably, like people felt very aggrieved with what they had to deal with there. It's a genuine act of God. It is a situation that you cannot plan for.
But with how many times NASCAR has been rained out? Does something like this ever come up in a NASCAR race that is pushed back to Monday or, God forbid, even Tuesday in some instances?
Yeah. And it feels like IndyCar should be able to model their behavior on the ground after NASCAR. But, well, that would be admitting that NASCAR is right about anything.
Well, let's put it to you this way. I know enough from insurance companies and friends that have worked with them to know that they will not pay out on an act of God. These things happen. But I know I'm pretty confident in saying from people that I know that work in insurance or have worked in insurance, they don't legislate for acts of God when weather would count as an act of God. So
they usually put it in the fine print of this, like, Microsoft, I believe, warranties their products, and one of the things they count as not covered by the warranty is acts of God. It's in the fine print. It's a very shitty situation that, unfortunately, everything that could have possibly conspired against IndyCar on the ground, in the air, and on the track all basically landed in the space of about 12 hours.
Yeah. I want to say a couple of things real quick. Sorry, I'll try to cut you. First of all, props to Doug Bowles, who apparently worked overtime calling up the affected ticket holders that were unfortunately on the wrong end of this mess. And I don't know what the outcome or the resolved outcome about it. I've known from people and friends that have got people within IndyCar's fan circle, he's doing his best to, quote, make it right. So, like I've said it before, and I'll say it again, Doug Bowles is a fantastic overall leader of the IMS Motor Speedway and the series as a whole. He puts the fans first, and I wish we had more people in the motorsport executive positions that had his attitude and approach to motorsport.
Right.
And that he deserves tremendous praise in that regard, because I know how hard he works for the fan, which is something that I wish we could say about more people in sports in general. It didn't help with all this backlash going on around on social media that one lead Fox presenter, a.k.a. Mr. William Buxton, went on Twitter and, when understandably fans are a little bit aggrieved, saying, one of them says, I hope they're planning on reimbursing the people who originally paid full price of a ticket, the difference down to $10, or else they've created another controversy for themselves. This is a perfectly reasonable tweet. It is understandable that, there's going to be some people felt hard done by that have maybe paid hundreds of dollars, not to mention travel, hotels, food, the whole package. And I say this as someone who's from a working class background. For a lot of people, a race like this would be your one big treat for the year. Summer months, this might be a holiday for some people. You might do the full weekend. You might do a week in that area or that town, or if you're a tourist, etc. You get the gist. You know, this is not cheap. And from a UK standpoint, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis right now. So for a lot of people, this is a treat. This is not a regular thing. This is not their routine. So for Will Buxton to respond to that tweet and say, and I quote, "That reminds me, I must claim a refund on my TV when its price inevitably gets reduced on Black Friday."
Which he's not, in that instant, in a vacuum, that's not like that egregious, but like it's a terrible case of not reading the room.
Like, first of all, it's factually incorrect. Some retailers do actually do this, where
I've experienced it at Costco,
where it's like
Best Buy.
Yeah, where you've bought an item, it suddenly goes to a heavy discount, and under the table, they will refund you the difference if there's a Black Friday or a sale reduction of some kind. Happens in the UK as well. It's happened at places like Asda because they sell a lot of TVs on Black Friday, a lot of electrical gear that suddenly goes on discount because they often, the people in the shops don't know what they're discounting until maybe hours before they actually open. So they will, as a make good, if you've bought it within a couple of weeks, they will refund you the difference. And shout out to Kira, the wonderful Kira in our Discord server, who actually let me know about that because I did not know that myself until she'd experienced that. But the thing is that it's a classless comment, and you've got to read the room better than that. There's a lot of pissed off, hot and bothered fans that have either had their garage passes revoked. They're probably suffering some from a degree of heat stroke because it was super hot down there in the first place. And their mood is probably in a really bad place because they're having to now go to a race on a Monday afternoon, which was not part of the plan. And for you as arguably the face of the series, as from a TV standpoint, someone with recognizable clout, someone that's been a part of F1 TV broadcasts for the better part of a decade, you can do better than that. You can, look, I need to tell this to people here. You can always say nothing. You can just shut the fuck up.
Yep. My favorite video game related tweet ever, the Doom Eternal official account. You control the buttons you press.
Right.
Right. And that applies to so much in life beyond
so much
social media. You control the buttons you press.
It's unfortunately just gotten worse and worse. It really has.
Like anonymous members of anonymous IndyCar teams going out there and sending threatening direct messages to people for like saying that like this shit sucks. And I'm like, it's all like,
that threatened right by now. Somebody. Go to therapy. Like, seriously.
Like, why are you like, leave the multi-billion-dollar corporation alone? Like, something shitty happened. IndyCar, as we know, like, Doug Bowles is trying to figure out a make-good program for these people, which is the right thing to do for your fans, who are the reason why you're around.
Some of the most dedicated and passionate fans in all of motorsport. IndyCar fans are hard fucking core to be be the way that they are.
Sometimes we see them in our inboxes. And to, like, it's just, it's classless, and it's like,
it's tactless. Dude,
it's just a bad, why are you punching down at your own fans? Because the only people you punch down with that comment.
And people, and a lot of people are misreading. It's like, people are criticizing IndyCar and, you know, and National Super Speedway and all because they care, because they want to see things get better in case this happens again. They're not doing this just for the hell of it. They want to make sure that if something like this happens again, that people are taken care of, and that, like, okay, the victory lane photos and all the other stuff that happened with IndyCar Nation that were canceled. Okay, let's bring that forward for either the next race in National Super Speedway, which assuming it's going to be back next year, or a future race either this year or next year on the IndyCar schedule. They say this because they want things to get better and to make things, and they care about this championship and these drivers and the teams and everything like that. They're not doing this just for the hell of it. Like, granted, it's a lot of fun to do on the
right by your fans. If you do right by your fans, typically your fans will do right by you.
Yeah.
If you punch down at your fans, why are you getting pissed off when they're punching back?
I did find it interesting, though. One of the weirdest things that happened was actually in a response to one of Bob Pockrass's tweets, that when he said that there was the tickets were only going to be $10, and a lot of people were confused because Santino Ferrucci responded, "They should probably just refund the tickets to those prices and open up the gates for free today."
Surprisingly based tweet from Santino Ferrucci, of all people.
More base than anything he's done this season.
No kidding. No, look, and I'm not going to turn this into a pot shot war. That's the sort of tweet that people will read and they will not come back.
Yep.
Exactly.
Like, that,
especially
that's
if this was, and think, Andre, what a perfect analogy, given that this was planned out to be the race to get a bunch of new people into the series.
Yeah.
That the only thing they achieved was probably turning a few people off of it.
Yeah.
Probably.
And the worst
son.
And probably the worst thing about it is that like none of this is IndyCar's fault directly.
Not at all.
These things happen. Like I said, it's an act of God. And yeah, you have to make do
we've got plenty of things we can brag on IndyCar that are in their control.
Right. This is not one of them.
And you have IndyCar's higher ups. Again, Doug Bowles does a very good job as an ambassador for this series. He's trying his best. And then you have your lead commentator basically say, "Well, fuck you guys for wanting more out of us."
Yeah.
It serves nobody. And it doesn't serve you either, Will.
Will the most of probably anybody on this panel, but I also recognize that every 6 to 9 months he is good for foot in mouth syndrome.
Yeah.
I generally like Will. I think some of his overkill enthusiasm rubs people the wrong way. I actually tend to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But this is just dumb.
That's just
I admit I'm not the biggest Buxton guy. I think he earned a bit of a pass for his brilliant call at the 500. He has these moments where he thinks he's above the series or whatever he's covering. And take it from me, who's been humbled a few times in this space, you don't want to be having that kind of ego when dealing with certain people, especially the fans, because they're the most important stakeholder you can have in your sport. If you lose them, you will never get them back. Don't be that person. You can always say nothing.
Yeah. One more thing on this as well. It's just like, I'm thinking to myself, like, how many people came to Nashville Super Speedway for the first time IndyCar race, and this whole weekend ended up being a disaster? As I remember, 2005 United States Grand Prix was my family's treat of a race. And
Oh, yeah. We
all know how that went. And that impacted the future perception of Formula One in the United States for another 5 years plus.
Yeah, that was a half a decade of America in bad faith when it came to Formula One. And it wasn't even really Formula One's fault. Not really. Yeah.
Forget F1 did not make good on that issue. It had to be Michelin who actually made good.
Michelin owned it. Yeah, Michelin owned it, and they refunded everybody and they did the right thing. But yeah, it's once those bridges are burned, it's very hard to get them back after that. And I want to like Buxton as a broadcaster, but those are the sorts of things where you don't stick your neck in there, because there's not very many good ways that ends, and there's very, very, very large amounts of ways where it can go horribly wrong, and that was one of them. And it's actually quite a neat segue into, and I know Max in our chat can relate to all this, because that man is chronically online, as much as we respect him. I noticed when I posted my race review of this on the website, the vibes around the series right now are rancid on Twitter. It is not a good place.
I mentioned earlier with people getting like random unsolicited threats from people who claim that they are members of IndyCar teams. I don't know who this person is. Clearly, they need therapy. They're not getting it because they're doing this through social media. But yeah. The vibes are just rancid. Like, I feel like, me personally, I don't relate to anybody on IndyCar Twitter other than like three people, and they're probably all in this car. Maybe you expand it out to like another three people and they all work in the series, dude. But just like,
yeah,
every conversation is exhausting. You know, we all know the problems of the series, but it just feels like there's never productive conversation that you know, goes anywhere beyond the same ground that we've treaded over the last year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, what have you.
It's tough right now.
That's what's draining some of the enthusiasm out of me. It's just like,
oh yeah,
at least back in the day, you know, this would be fun to talk about. Now it's just not.
Like, it's become genuinely exhausting for me to talk about IndyCar on social media because it feels like I'm ragging on the series every 2 seconds when I don't want to do that. I talked about it when I had that famous rant about it after the 500, where I was unfathomably pissed at many elements of the series.
Right.
Like, I had a scroll of a few tweets here and there. First of all, some of the NASCAR lot were very ticked off when Scott Dixon's comments about their series were massively taken out of context. Basically, Dixon said, listen, like, maybe your NASCAR races are a little bit long. I can get a nap in between a NASCAR race. And
look, people will tell you the same thing about most of their races being too long, dog.
Yeah, like, honestly, and this is partly my own fault as a Brit who actually does watch NASCAR on a semi-frequent basis now, some of those races can go 3, 4, 5 hours. That's too long.
Yeah.
It's not like an endurance race where you're building up for like 5 or 6 of these over a season and you're a bit more mentally prepared. Like, watching a 3.5, 4 hour race every Sunday is mentally exhausting sometimes.
Also on principle, like, why are the NASCAR fans on social media? Why do they feel the need to punch down? You already control American motorsport. The vibes are great in your series. Like, you should be happy with what you have.
You must defend the billion-dollar corporation.
Yeah, and this being NASCAR, which has done, like, has poured billions of dollars into destroying their standing with like American sport over the last 15 years and are only just now this year back to some semblance of an acceptable point system because they pissed and shat themselves every time they saw that Lowe's 48 coming.
This message is awesome by Taylor Farms Lettuce.
No. We should also probably just bring this up too, is that like when back in the day when NASCAR races were 3 or 4 hours long, like you had the opportunity for a narrative to be built up without having the stage cautions and things like that. But the stage cautions have completely killed that, number one. Number two, back then you were willing to do 3 or 4 hours, you know, of a NASCAR race because the schedule wasn't as long. There's 36 races now. I think 36, right?
They've been 36 for a very, very long
exactly.
time.
Exactly. Well, there's also like the All-Star race or the Clash. It's like, okay. But back in like, you know, before the expansion into Kansas, Chicago, and things like that, there were like
34
races. 26, 27, 28, 29 races.
Yeah.
You had time off. Couple weeks, you know, a few weeks where there were no races and you could actually just, you know, enjoy your Sunday, do this, that, whatever. But it's like it's every single week. I think they've already had their one off week and they're running all the way through until November, unless I'm missing something in the schedule.
Yeah,
but it's like,
more or less.
Like, the fatigue factor, like IndyCar's getting ready to go through with that with this stretch of racing coming up because this weekend coming up is an off weekend, and then you've got Portland, Oregon, Markham, Ontario, Washington, D.C., Milwaukee twice, and then you've got Laguna Seca, which that's 6 races in 5 weeks. You're going all the way crisscrossing across the continent, plus a border crossing to Canada and back to the United States. On top of that, a lot of these teams, like every single team, the crew that works on the cars at the shop are also the crew that travels with the team as well. Like in NASCAR, there's a lot of, you know, crew that rotates in and out. In fact, I think the shop crew might just be the shop crew. They don't actually travel at all. It's going to be exhausting for all of them. And unless there's any heaven forbid, there's any testing. You're going to be kidding me.
Speaking of testing, to that effect, within the next 2 weeks, the IR-28 finally, might be on track.
You've even said that you won't believe it until you see 25 of them on track at St. Pete.
I'm not going to believe it until we're at least 300 miles into the 2029 Indy 500. I'm like, is this actually a DW12 under here? I don't believe it. Oh, Dan, there's a Lotus sticker. Oh, no, it's blown up. Oh,
and it's worth pointing out as well, because I know DeHardy mentioned fatigue a minute ago. Hello, fatigue. And I feel really bad for Alex in this regard, is that every time Polo is in contention or wins a race like he did this past weekend, it's now a bunch of bad faith, shitty comments about Polo being dominant. I mean, don't get me wrong. I come from a sports mad United Kingdom where we hate dominant winners. I think Manchester City is like the one dominant winner we don't hate on repeatedly because we just don't care about them like that. But besides the 115 charges, but besides that,
please be sure to at VIP Swift on Twitter.
Yeah, of course. I'll leave Stasher alone. But no, like it's one of those ones where it's, I feel horrible for Alex because the man's getting a lot of abuse, a lot of hateful messages, and people are having to defend him simply for doing his job better than everybody else. And don't get me wrong, I know it's embedded into the American culture to hate dominant winners. I get that. That's the element. That's sports fandom in a nutshell. What have I always said on this show? Sports fandom is built on a healthy bed of hatred.
Right.
I don't mean that it's not unfair that it's getting a bit ridiculous that one of the nicest people in the paddock, one of the genuinely brilliant ambassadors for this series, this man who has batted for IndyCar relentlessly from day one, one of the guys that should be a fan favorite, really, and I know he still has an absolute massive share of fans for a fair share of them around. But even so, the amount of people that are dunking on Alex simply for existing is ridiculous.
Well, Dre, you've been through it as a Vettel and Schumacher fan. Cam, you've been through it as a Vettel and Schumacher fan.
Absolutely.
Any number of people have been through it as a Jimmy Johnson or a Jeff Gordon fan from back in the day. There was like Sebastian fatigue in the World Rally Championship. I think maybe the only dominant champion that never got this much flack was Valentino Rossi back in the day. The same people winning all the freaking time.
Well, but right here, in my inbox, I got that was insane bullshit luck. How did Alex win that race in a derogatory sense? So that's racing. And the thing is, he got to the front. He still needed to hold off a god around Nashville and two other busted Penske's when Maluka's probably had the best car on the day. He drove his nuts off to come from last to finish where he did.
Nearly passed out after the race was over.
But it's not just Alex.
So, given the hit that he took.
It's not, like I said, it's not just Alex that's doing his job. He's got one of the best race strategists in IndyCar, and Barry Wanzer on the stand, who, you know, he's
the golden horseshoe.
Exactly.
It's Chip Ganassi equipment coupled to excellent staff, coupled to excellent engines, coupled to a phenomenal driver.
I was about to say and then you're also having to factor in Julian Robertson, who, you know, if you were doing an IndyCar fantasy team and you had the next pick was engineer, him, Craig Hampson, Michael Cannon, Luke Mason, those are pretty much going to be your top four that you're going to be looking at. Or Mike Colliver, who I think is over at Coin right now. Those are your top, and probably your top five picks, because they're just that good at what they do.
It's the exact same thing that all landed together with Red Bull, with Max and the RB19 in 2023. You had statistically the winningest F1 car ever spawned, the best driver in the world, and the most devastatingly effective pit crew to run it, and the best engine in the sport at the time that Honda was producing, all at the same time. When all of those things land together, shit gets scary for everyone else, and it does get fatiguing. the thing that I think makes this difference is that Alex is doing it in the series that prided its entire fucking existence on not being that, wide open, because mostly spec.
Don't worry, though. Once we get this new car in the way, Alex Pillow's reign of dominance is over, because he knows how to drive a DW12 that's been maxed out with Chip Ganassi racing equipment. It's not like Alex Pillow regularly dabbles in other forms of motorsport and it sells at them like he's been doing this full time for about 5 years. Sorry,
second
hold up.
I'm getting some of my prototype driver at the Daytona 24 behind my other early investment in Lauren Heinrich.
He's not going to win every championship for the next 15 years straight, but to think that Alex Pillow's just going to be a bum in short order once they reset the regulations is just asinine and foolish, and you do not know ball, man. He's one of the most adaptable drivers in top-level motorsports.
And RJ, what are we doing with the next cars? We're changing them up, and we're bumping up the horsepower, and we're bumping up the hybrid systems eventually. Maybe we'll see what happens with that. I don't trust IndyCar in that regard. Oh, well, what's Alex Pillow an absolute fucking machine at doing? Managing rear tires when there's a lot of wheel spin.
Good luck with
that, everyone else. Look,
there'll be some reset, but like, it's not going to be like this is the end of it.
No, it's ridiculous.
But, I think that makes the fatigue so much stronger is that Alex. Like, your championship is probably going to come out of Ganassi or Penske, or maybe Andretti if the year is particularly spicy.
Kirkwood's still a threat right now. It wouldn't take a huge amount to get Kirkwood back in this race.
But then one guy comes in and reels off. It looks like it's going to be 5 and 6 years.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's incredible, dog.
Dario wasn't this. Dixon never retained his title. At least Dixon gave you a break.
Dario Franchitti was certifiably him, and he was not this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know we've talked about people in and out of IndyCar. I want to give one great person a shout-out, Devin Altieri, who's absolutely fantastic as a paddock presence to have in there. And she's talked to me about, I was there when Dario was there, but Pillow wasn't this. And she knows that man on a personal level. And, it is ridiculous.
Please, how special. Please, my HRC car, please get that contract signed. I need it on my desk.
The silly season is kicked off, and it kicked off huge because this is significant. Maybe came down to the desk today, Wednesday, July 22nd. Race Paul Letterman Lanigan Racing is the first team with an IndyCar charter to sell an IndyCar charter. We always knew it could happen. Didn't think it'd be them first. It's been sold to Dreyer and Reinbold Racing, who I had a feeling was going to get in. Some of us kind of thought maybe it's buying up some of what is now Juncos Hollinger. No, they've got one of RLL's three charters for 2027, bringing Dreyer Reinbold back as a full-time team for the first time in over a decade.
This is a good move for RLL, in my opinion. When the team was only two cars, they were actually really, really good. Yeah. I think sometimes when you try and do more, you end up doing worse because you're having to spread your resources a little thin. I don't think the team was properly built to do a third car.
Fully agree.
Like when you had Takuma Sano and Graham Rahal as your only two entries, I still remember at Barber in 2019, they locked out the front row there. And Sano won that race. Unfortunately, Graham had a technical gremlin on that day. But I think
with the 500 on the board with Sato.
Exactly. I think the expansion of three cars ultimately has not proven to be as successful. Although we say that, and we'll get to the dry ramble thing in a bit, but like with everything going on, I still, this has to be brought up now, cause I don't think it's going to be brought up again in the episode. I didn't have it on my bingo card that Mick Schumacher would get his first IndyCar top 10 finish on an oval.
You know, like, they're saying that Mick Schumacher is an oval specialist. They're saying he's the new Ed Carpenter. They're saying he's the new for a move to NASCAR.
So many people.
So in all fairness, I was actually keyed in, like when I saw the final practice on Saturday, I saw Mick was fourth fastest. Yeah. And I'm like, I need to make a mental note of this. So I did a little article after.
No, you only said to it three times in our Discord server about Mick being strong in practice. People people are absolutely obsessed with Mick Schumacher's time in IndyCar.
It's
a little strange.
That's why I went after doing a story about him afterwards, because he has a very large fan base. Hey, there was one NASCAR writer back in the early 2000s that was trying to break into the sport. His strategy, we're going to write about Dale Earnhardt Jr. every single week. And that's how he's still in the sport today. I think that might have been caught. I don't know. Anyway, eighth place finish for Mick Schumacher. Fantastic job by him. The team, I was listening to the radio for much of the race. Like, they were really impressed with what he was doing behind the wheel with the changes to the car setup and all. But yeah, it was a great job for him. But to go back to now, the big news of the day. So contracting down from three cars to two. So what does Rail Letterman Lanigan Racing look like for next year? Louis Foster has a multi-year extension signed with Rail Letterman Lanigan Racing. However, as we've seen before in the past, contracts are merely suggestions, as Kevin Lee would like to say on Trackside with Kirk Cavan and Kevin Lee. That's not a plug. Might be. Anyway, so Foster seemingly has one of those seats locked up. What happens to the other seat? Graham Rahal, I think he would acknowledge, is closer to the end of his career than to the beginning of the career. Could he step out of the car for 2027? It's possible. If he does, Mick might stay. Or Mick might go if Graham Rahal stays another year. Or could we see Graham and Mick drive next year? There's a lot to work out here, people. It's like the Charlie Day thing.
All I can hope is that in this contraction to two cars, every oval engineer involved with the number 15 team is not only fired from that team, but is actively blacklisted from IndyCar forever.
Oh my God.
They couldn't figure out what was wrong with Graham Rahal's car. He said the car does not feel right. They sent him out. It was the right rear upright, and he immediately crashed. He was a lot more politically correct in the post-crash interview than I ever would have been.
On the scanner, I heard him say, I've told you all guys a million times, this car is broken. It was a piece leading into the upright that was failed. And also, wait, we haven't even gotten to the other part yet. The engine couldn't maintain, car couldn't maintain fuel pressure. He never even went out to qualify.
Wood chipper, beehive, mud wasps.
I think
German shepherds.
I think the medieval plan would be being tarred and feathered on this occasion. But yeah, I mean, the way I see
the boats.
If this was the Graham Rahal of 2025, I would genuinely be a lot more intrigued as to whether he would actually walk away from his own team. Graham Rahal's actually been pretty decent this year. He has three podium finishes this season. And could have easily had a fourth if it wasn't for his own blocking at Road America. But even so, he's driven very well this season. He's bounced back from a big old skid in terms of his career trajectory. So I'd be shocked if it was anyone other than Rahal and Louis Foster in those two seats. What intrigues me about RLR, I fully agree with what everyone else has said about them downsizing. I've been saying for years they've stretched themselves too thin with a three-car team because it's never really gotten them anywhere good in that time span. Two things that intrigue me. The first one has been obviously who takes those two seats. I think it will be Rahal and Foster. I think that's relatively straightforward. I think the issue for me is that, or what was raised an eyebrow of me was reportedly $13 million. That's $13 million. For that charter, that's less than I thought it was going to be, mostly because the only other yardstick we've got is when Mr. Splendor bought half of ECR, and that was rumored to be $40 million, and that includes half of those two charters they had. Now, I think once you factor in all the other resources, a factory, the parts, obviously your staff contracts, all of that, that adds a significant extra millions onto that deal. I thought a guaranteed permanent seat in IndyCar with the leader circle perks, because remember, you need to charter to be leader circle eligible for the extra 1 million and change at the end of the season. I thought that would be worth a lot more than $13 million because from what I've been told, it's about 5 mil to run a car for the year. So, like, one of your three charters, a third of basically your entrance fee to get into the series or your golden ticket to be on the grid is only worth 13 mil?
It's going to be, this is a situation where the first sale sets the market and it will only go up from there in theory.
You'd think.
Well, so I bring this up because like I have a list right here of the charter sales that have taken place. This is all from court documents from the antitrust lawsuit with NASCAR in 2311. The very first charter that was sold was back in 2016 from Michael Waltrip Racing to Stuart Haas or to Joe Gibbs. And the price, it doesn't give the exact dollar. It gives like a range, was between $1.25 million and $3.25 million. This was back in 2016.
Yeah.
Fast forward to the following year, Tommy Baldwin Racing gets one from Levine Family or goes to Levine Family Racing for $3.5 million. The most recent charter sale that I see on here is from Stuart Haas Racing to Trackhouse Racing, $26.5 million. Oh, and they also sold one to 2311 for $28 million, one to Front Row Motorsports for $29.5 million, and Live Fast sold one to Spire Motorsport in 2024 for
$40 million.
Good God. 40 mil for one charter.
So this is me basically being Bugs Bunny, just counting the $100 bills, just
slapping them down.
Exactly.
Crazy. Yeah, it goes to show you. I mean, yeah, I fully agree that this will only go up. I think IndyCar overall is in a pretty good place. The TV numbers are about 20% up on last year. The series, I think, actually has got some genuine growth now it's on Fox, which is good. These are all steps in the right direction, and I think it will inevitably only go. Like, normally with these sorts of things like charters, like line go up. It's going to take a lot for that line to go down afterwards, because now you've set the tone. You now put some more inherent value on what your charter's worth. And again, if your team is up, higher up the field, it's only going to be worth more. So, yeah, and you remember the manufacturers are now getting one of these charters too, which is only going to add extra value because they now have their hands in the cookie jar too.
Come on down, Kaku Oda.
Kaku Oda, who won two out of the three Super Formula races this past weekend at Fuji Speedway.
Two before me, son of a bitch.
We've all gotten in the habit of watching these together. By the way, that was a dominant weekend. That now puts him 50.5 points in front, two and a half races worth of points. He's odds on favored to win the Super Formula Championship. And we know that despite all the bad vibes that we just discussed in IndyCar, Kakuno Shinoda really wants to drive in America and specifically drive an IndyCar and specifically run the Indianapolis 500, but also be full-time in IndyCar. The only trouble is that, like, if he wins the title, it's going to feel like, well, I've done everything I've set out to do a year ahead of time. I don't have to go back to Japan for 2027, but I may have no choice because seat's not going to open up for me until the Honda charter car comes online in 2028.
Which it hasn't been officially confirmed yet, but that is the ongoing rumor mill, is that Kakuno Shinoda is the Honda chartered car that's going to be with Meyer Shank Racing. So we just want to make sure we clarify that right now, because to this, to date, no official release has gone out yet, but that is what is rumored to be the situation.
There's still time to hype up more Yuki Tsunoda to IndyCar rumors that will never happen.
I want a picture of him standing next to Graham Rahal.
That would be funny, actually.
I've seen that man stand side by side with Dirk Nowitzki. We've already got that shit covered. It's out there on the internet. Don't you worry. That's a nearly 2 foot difference between men right there. I mean, holy hell. But yeah, I mean, that's been flying around. There's rumblings that Rinus VK might be the number one name for the Meyer Shank 66 seat.
Yes.
That
Shank, you do that.
If you can't get Christian Lingard, you snap his ass right up now. That boy's nice.
If I'm Chip Ganassi, I'm calling VK too.
Yeah, like Lingard, he was on the same strategy as David Malik at the start of the race, but he just fell straight back through the field. Like if I'm Chip Ganassi, like everybody's hyping up Lingard this, Lingard that, but Rinus VK finished fourth at Mid-Ohio, and he finished fourth at Gateway, and had a top 10 at the 500 for Ricardo Juncos's team.
He's single-handedly making Juncos not look like a minnow team.
Yeah, and like if I'm looking at, I don't understand how he's not higher up on the radar. Like, okay, I can understand why people are like gassing Lingard massively because, you know, he had the win at Road America. He almost had the win at Barber. The win at the Indy Road Course. And he's so good right now in points. But like IndyCar is three distinct disciplines. Well, two and a half, you want to do road courses, street courses, like separate and all. But it is still also a series where you have to be good on ovals if you're going to be a championship winning driver. And it just has not come together for Lingard there. For VK, he's that guy.
And the thing is as well, no matter how we slice it, it's an oval championship. And I think this year has really emphasized that point this year, that it is an oval priority championship right now. Rinus has been one of the 500's best qualifiers since he showed up in the series. That is a guy that could probably get you into the fast six of the 500, regardless of car. That's a very strong trait to have as a driver.
Put in a Chip Ganassi. I can be damn sure about that.
Like three front row starts in the 500 before he got to his, fourth or fifth race?
Real talk. Yep. Like, I know Kiffin Simpson pays for his seat and he's not terrible, but that's an automatic upgrade to the eight. Like, why not just have VK and Lingard in the eight and the nine right here and now alongside?
No, that would probably be the best. That's the best solution for everybody, but we all know that Chip Ganassi will not subsidize more than two seats of it out of his and his own sponsored pocket. It's
put one of them in the 66 then, because that's a technical partnership car. It's as good as a main Ganassi car at this point.
It's a lot of overthinking for what is going to be the inevitable. Christian Lundgaard's going to get the 9, and Rinus VK is going to get the 66 Shank car.
Lingard's too good not to get the 9 seat. Because he's a cutter. Like, his road and street course is the second best in the series. He's too good not to. Like, if you want a guaranteed Aster Cup contender, you're taking Christian Lingard like that. And if you've got Alex Palou, whose bread and butter was road and street courses before the ovals came later, not too much later, but later, the same principle could easily work with Christian Lingard. Like, for me, it's just a no-brainer. Then let the rest of the market dictate itself. Also, before I go, Christian Rasmussen, fraud watch, right here and now.
Sticky.
Sticky
ass. Look, here's the thing with Christian Rasmussen. He's been abhorrent on road courses, but we knew that going in. Oval championship. When you're not doing anything on ovals either, that hits about 10 times harder. And,
you got a multi-year...
Into the wall.
You got a multi-year extension based on your oval prowess, because it wasn't for the road and street course form. You're 22nd in points. You're only 14 above the leader's circle cut line. Something has to give there.
You know, if we all said that Graham Rahal had a weekend to forget, the silver medal in that category might be Ed Carpenter Racing as a whole, because Alexander Rossi.
I disagree, Chris. Because I can't forget how bad ECR's weekend was. Notably bad. It was hard to forget.
Oh, yeah. Lingard hits the outside wall, breaks a toe link, day is done. I don't know what Alex Rossi was doing with that pit entry that had Dixon driving. Like, I think that was 100% on Alex Rossi. I don't know what he was doing. Like,
I thought that was grid penalty worthy for the next race. I fully agree.
I don't know what Rossi... And it's baffling as well that Rossi took zero accountability.
That's your answer.
Like, he took zero accountability for it after. It's like, oh, I don't know what happened, man. And I'm like, you forgot to turn into pit road. That's what happened. We could all see.
Yeah, he was a lane or a lane and a half too high on the racetrack. But yeah, I'm looking forward to when Off Track comes out and then we hear what all happened.
The world has progressed beyond the need of hearing from Alexander Rossi.
Hey, I'm sorry. There's one thing I love, it's chaos. So I love...
I James Hinchcliffe wakes up every day, and you know what he thinks? I'm going to go listen to my friend Alexander Rossi.
He's a better man.
Hi, Becky. How are you?
You know what? That might come second.
How's your latest brilliant Hallmark movie? God, what a woman. IndyCar is back in 2 weeks' time for Portland. Could be another interesting case like last year. Could be Powell, Lundgaard, and Polo battling for the win. That could be very interesting. Those three were very strong last year.
The Willpower Revenge Tour will finally get on the tracks before it inevitably goes flying off the bridge.
They'll figure something out. But yeah, Portland in a couple of weeks' time. Follow Krista Hardy at Cedar Hardy on Twitter, please. And thank you before we go. We'll be back for Formula One's review of the Hungarian Grand Prix sometime next week. Now I'm going to beat my head against the wall while I try and edit all these clips together. I've been Trey Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell, Calvin Buckley, and Krista Hardy. Thank you very much for sitting and watching. We'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Oh yeah, we didn't bring up that Malukas had the little pink ducky in his driver's suit, and Jesus.
Yeah, but who needs Jesus when you've got that damn Spaniard?